Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Natural Born Hunter podcast. I am your host, Will Bradley, along with my co-host, Phil, the Iceman Mendoza. And we are joined tonight by a previous Natural Born Hunter guest, who I'm sure you all know and love, even though he is a little bit of a liberal, AJ DeRosa, who has recently returned from Africa, which I feel like it's pretty timely considering all the stuff going on and the heat they're getting over there for hunting. So we're going to be digging into that a little bit, digging into the films he's got going out on the film tours, and see what else is going on in his life and get a little update with Mr. DeRosa. Phil, how you doing tonight?
Hey, man, I'm good. I can't see the screen, but I'm good.
That's good. I noticed you are sporting a flat brim, and is that what's keeping you from being too close to the mic that we can hear you?
Yeah, I don't know how to act with this brim this close to my nose, so I'm just kind of keeping my distance from the screen and the mic and everything else.
You know, with a flat brim hat, you can actually keep it above your eyebrows.
First time, man. I'm rookie, so I mean, you have to teach me.
You look a little bit like a burn victim. No offense to any burn victims, but, I mean, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I'm not – yeah.
You know what? Maybe you should try it on backwards. There we go. That looks – no, I think backwards is the way you should be sporting a flat brim hat.
I don't know that I should be sporting a flat brim hat, period.
No, that's good.
We're going to give it a whirl.
Yeah, it looks good. It looks good. I don't even have that one. How'd you get that one?
I bought it.
That's good.
Yeah.
So, and whose hat is that you're supporting?
This would be a Mountain Ops hat.
Oh, Mountain Ops. And you know what I love about Mountain Ops?
Tell me, Will.
I love the fact that if you go buy something, one of their great supplements or pieces of clothing or hats or sweet flat brim, the nice, you know, gray and white one that Phil is sporting tonight, if you enter the promo code NBH20, you can get 20% off your Mountain Op purchase. And if you're like me, you do not want to pay full price for anything. So a promo code like that will certainly come in handy. AJ, are you a fan of promo codes?
Oh, yeah. For sure. I also don't pay full price for anything.
That's what I'm talking about. At some point in your life, you decide, listen, I just can't.
That's it.
Pay full price. Just can't do it. Where the promo code's at. Well, Phil, they're right here on the Natural Born Hunter podcast. And if you go to Mountain Ops, NBH20.
Oh, man, does this mean I have to give up a Dangerous Cow Publishing?
Yes.
Code now.
That's right. Next up, free books. AJ DeRosa. All the books are free from Dangerous Cow Publishing. That's right. You want a copy of the Urban Deer Complex, he's going to give it to you. Only tonight on the Natural Born Hunter podcast.
Leave it to Will to give away the farm, huh?
First person to call into the podcast gets a book for free.
Can you even call into this? I don't even understand how this thing works.
Yeah. No, but I will say I do want to throw a shout out. I started mixing the Yeti and Enduro, and
like a pro. That's how pros take supplements.
And I tell you what, I was mixing. I'm trying to get off the energy drink kick because I do dabble with the energy drinks.
What's your energy drink of choice?
You know what, man? I do a little bit of the Monster stuff. I do a little bit of the Red Bull stuff. I have not been able to get my hands on a Kill Cliff yet.
Mean right here?
Yeah. I hit up
a
vitamin store down the road the other day, and they don't sell Kill Cliff. Can you believe it?
I can believe that. The one by us sells Kill Cliff, and that's in Utica, New York, which is much smaller than Denver from what I understand.
Yeah. So, anyway, I'm trying to get off that kick, but maybe Killcliff can throw some energy drinks my way. I'll still dabble with those guys, but that Yeti helped me pack that bull off the mountain pretty good. It was one tripper. The bull that I shot in New Mexico last weekend.
You shot a bull in New Mexico last weekend?
Yes, I did.
I didn't know that. I haven't seen any pictures of.
Yeah, you don't read my Facebook posts.
Who would read a post that comes with a picture?
My partner in crime on the Natural Born. Can you believe that, AJ? He's my partner. Says, "Hey Phil, throw me pictures, man. We got to get the social media thing going." So I throw a picture up. I tag Natural Born Hunter. Right.
But where did you throw the picture up?
On my personal page.
Right. And how does that help Natural Born Hunter if it's on your damn personal page?
Because I said, if you want details, you got to listen to the Natural Born Hunter podcast. So these, is what it says.
These are the sweet, sweet honey details we're
giving
people tonight.
That's why. You gotta read. I mean, if you're just if you're your closet Facebooker or Instagram person that just flips through and waits for the half naked chick to show up, and you just want to filter through the bats, the average stuff, like your partner shooting a bull, and you want to wait for the half naked chick that comes down the feed, hey man, that's your own thing.
I'm not friends with any women on Facebook, Phil, so I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Hey,
I'm a happily married man, Mr. Mendoza.
I'm sorry about that, Will. I window shop all the time.
You ever get caught window shopping?
Yeah.
After this podcast.
You ever had it pulled up and have someone like walk over and be like, "What are you looking at?" Sports.
No.
Sports.
No. I don't do that. But AJ, man, you just traveled halfway around the world. Where have you been?
Africa. Yeah, Africa. South Africa, Mozambique, a little bit of Botswana.
It's always been a place that it's on my list to get to, and my wife does not want me to get there. But, I mean, from start to finish, I guess I'm curious because, is there anything as far as, like, medications you had to worry about, any vaccinations you needed to do ahead of time? Tell us about the preparation for that trip I guess.
No, I think with a liberal like AJ, they were more worried about what they would catch from him. He's gonna catch from that.
Yeah, I'm from Boston. I run a nightclub, but I was coming with things they'd never heard of. But so the areas that I were in, there's not many requirements as far as what you have to have. You go really far north once you start hitting up to, like, Ethiopia, stuff like that. That's when they start requiring you to get certain types of shots. You had to have an updated tetanus shot. We were in a malaria hotspot. If you want to, you can take malaria medication. I didn't. I live in, like, the Lyme disease capital of the country. So they even had stuff like some African flu or something you get from ticks out there that was pretty rampant. I didn't have any of those problems, and I'm generally a reckless person, so.
Ebola, was Ebola a concern at all? Wasn't that big last time?
So we landed in Ghana, but we didn't get off the plane, and in that area, Ebola is a thing. But we never got off the plane. They came in and actually sprayed all sorts of, like, virus-killing aerosol onto the plane in between the flight and stuff when we landed in Ghana, which was pretty weird, but. Other than that, no. Everybody I know was like, "Oh, poisonous snakes, poisonous spiders, and diseases and death." And I've hunted the South plenty of times, and I saw a hell of a lot more snakes in the South. I'll tell you that. And they were all poisonous down there. I only saw one snake the whole time I was there, and it was essentially their equivalent of garden snake, and I caught it and took pictures of it, and that was it. And then other than this big old nasty spider that was living in the corner of my bathroom in one of my one of the cabins we were staying in, I didn't see any spiders. And I'd walk in my room and check up, make sure he was still there. I figured I was good. As long as he was there, I was good. If he disappeared, then we had a problem. But he was big. He looked like an over-glorified Daddy Long Legs, just a really mean one. As far as that stuff, honestly, what's dangerous over there is, South Africa is essentially supposed to be the most stable part of the southern part of the continent. And even South Africa was corrupt. The corruption in that place in general is just, it's just over the top. It's crazy. I mean, it's literally the theme of everywhere you go.
Now, worse than Mexico?
I mean, it's different in the sense of,
Corruption are we talking here?
Anything. I mean, there's everything going on there. Human trafficking, blood diamonds, you know, just political corruption. We were staying in an area with a lot of platinum mines, and they have riots in these platinum mines, and the police and the miners have full-out gunfights, and like 50 people get killed. It's like normal there. It's just a really different world. Everything. The best way I can describe Africa is everything is just extremes. You know, there's nothing really basic about it, and as far as the culture is concerned, they're stuck 100 years behind us. Racism is like nothing you would ever think you'd see in modern life. Just all sorts of things out there that
give us examples that won't get us hate mail on the show.
We'll always get with me involved. We'll always get hate mail. there's just huge segregation between you know, white people and black people there, and white people are a minority. And you know, to be very fair to the issue, and again, coming from a liberalist, being more fair than ever, you know, the white people there tend to have more money, higher educations. You know, it's a foothold that was left there from the Germans and the British, and they own a lot. And you have, you know, essentially a competing community that's essentially saying, okay, this isn't right. We should have some of this. And it's creating severe, severe racial issues. And it's honestly, I'm way underqualified on the topic to even divulge into how complicated the politics involved in that truly are.
Fair enough. This is a hunting show after all. What was the hunting like in Africa?
Since this is Natural Born Hunter and you like a good bomb, I was severely disappointed with hunting Africa.
What?
Yeah, there's your bomb.
What do you mean? Let me ask you this. Do you feel like you were disappointed because most people would go there and be disappointed if they had that experience? Or do you feel like I know your name, the Dangerous Cow name, is based off of, you know.
I had very high expectations going there.
You know, do you think your expectations were realistic and they?
No.
No, okay. So you probably had maybe a higher expectations than most people, I would assume, you know, going into the hunt. Maybe a romanticized version, perhaps, or...
I think the hardest part, I think the most difficult part for me hunting Africa is, you know, I come from being a diehard big buck hunter, and hunting big whitetails to date for me is the hardest thing I've ever done, and I went there with expecting a real challenge. And again, I think you're right in the sense of like, yeah, I had a very over-glorified view of what to expect, particularly with dangerous game hunting. But I guess I just never put two and two together. It's dangerous game. So, you know, if whitetails weren't afraid of us, they'd be much easier to hunt. and that's pretty much what this gets down to. I mean, a Cape Buffalo that weighs, you know, well over 1,000 pounds in a herd of 100+ Cape Buffalo is not afraid of you. And as a result, they're very tolerant to your presence, making it very easy to hunt them. It was also very dry while I was there. So again, it was a little bit of an unfair perspective for me because they were desperate for water. The area that I was hunting, there was very little water. It was very easy to essentially, once you found that water, to find them. And essentially, the way they hunt there, and again, I don't want to lump all of Africa into a hole because, you know, as I'm sure I'll say later in this podcast, Africa is a vastly complex and different place from one area to the next. And it just wasn't, you know, you can walk right at them. They literally walk right at these animals. They run, and then they walk at them again, and walk at them again, and walk at them again, until eventually the animal gives up. And the hardest part is just waiting for the animal you're going to shoot to clear the herd and take the shot. It just wasn't what I expected. I've shot does that I was more excited after than dropping a Cape Buffalo.
You know,
quite honest.
This is the thing. Some people will go there. I recently listened to, and I think I sent it to you, Radiolab did a podcast with the guy who won the black rhino hunt. Mm-hmm. And they talked, while he was there, talked to a European guy who seemed to really just care about getting a trophy animal, you know, getting an animal on the ground to take home.
Yeah.
If you're not a person who is per se hunts for those reasons or gets that excited about that reason, maybe cares more about the process of hunting than they do, you know, getting an animal on the ground, then I could definitely see how something like that would be a bit of a disappointment.
Yeah, I'm definitely not, you know, I was more interested in trying, you know, eating Cape Buffalo at the end of the day once this went down, or eating kudu, or, you know, impala, or, you know, whatever else we were hunting. And that's the truth of there are people, and, you know, this is the debate, trophy hunting, what are people doing there, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, there's people there that go in there to bring a head home. There's no doubt about it. I think you'd be a liar if any of us said otherwise. But there's two misconceptions in that. One is the misconception that animal's not being used, which couldn't be further from the truth. They use everything out there. I mean, when I shot that Cape Buffalo, I filmed it. I stayed with the villagers right through them, cutting it up and everything else. Actually, the professional hunters left me with a bunch of people and, you know, spoke Zulu, and and I just hung out there. And, you know, that's it. They even, you know, they emptied the bowels of literally the feces that was in there to use it for their garden. That's how in-depth of using these animals they're into. And that's about every animal, even a lion. Like, people that think that lions aren't getting eaten, they are. They eat lion meat out there. It's normal. It's not uncommon. Just like if you go to Italy, in Italy they eat horse. We don't eat horse here. You know, it's just a different separation in culture. And the other misconception is that that money isn't helping. Where I was, the money is 100% helping. From the level of corruption that I saw, I'm sure there's plenty of places where that money's not helping. And that's not because hunting is bad. It's because it's being abused. You know, it's being abused for other reasons, not for a conservation tool. It's being abused for a for-profit tool by corrupted governments or whatever else.
I thought you can get horse meat at McDonald's.
I think it's they undisclose what's actually in there.
Sorry.
I don't even think there's meat in McDonald's hamburgers for the record. So.
Wait. How did that taste first? How did the Cape Buffalo taste?
So I have a tradition of eating any animal I kill raw. So I cut a piece of the back strap out and eat it raw. It was very light in color. It was very pinkish and had almost no flavor to it. I expected it to be very gamey. I expected it to be very dark, like venison. It wasn't. It was very flavorless. It was essentially like, honestly, the best way I could say it's like the chicken of red meat. It was good. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't like you can't really pin a flavor on it. I guess not to be repeated, but, you know, we weren't supposed to take, any of the back straps out of there because it was a quarantine zone for me, but I took them anyways. And we ate them that night. We grilled them out. But it was just, you know, it was good. You know, and that was obviously part of my interest to be in there, is I really wanted to eat everything I shot, and I did. And, you know, and then the rest of that animal went to, you know, pretty much the majority of the meat went to the village. Some of that meat actually went to feed lions inside Kruger National Park, stuff like that. It's very, like, widespread of what they're doing with these animals. And as far as the conservation angle and this, and Will mentioned the beginning and the time frame of me going there, a lot of why I wanted to be there related to I want to see firsthand what people want to be keyboard warriors about, you know, like what they're saying. They know allegedly so much about African hunting and what it's doing and what it's not doing. And, you know, the first thing, again, like I said, when I came home is I can say that there's no one answer. You can't simplify the question to is hunting okay or not in Africa. It's not that basic. But in the case of where we were, particularly Cape Buffalo hunting, essentially for somebody to pull a trigger on a Cape Buffalo, a female Cape Buffalo, it was a management tag. It's very controlled by the government. The government says the carrying capacity of our land right now says that X amount of these animals can be here, and particularly because of a dry season, we need to take so many off because these animals are starving. You go in, and there's photographic tours going on there, and now they radio to photographic tours. They take them out of the area, and now hunters, you know, we show up as a hunting party, and we start tracking animals, and as we move, they radio, check where our location is, and they move these photography, you know, people further into different parts of the parks and whatever else, so, you know, we're all steered away. And the big difference is we stayed in the same lodge as, you know, essentially these photographers would. We stayed, you know, we spent ate at the same places. We spent the same money. All this money went right in, like photo, you know, ecotourism, you know, photo tourism does. The big difference was, is I killed an animal that they were going to have to kill no matter what. So no matter what, they're going to kill that cow, because they said this Cape Buffalo is over the carrying capacity. We have to kill X amount, and whether we can sell the permits or not, we're still killing this many. We paid essentially a little over $3,000 to pull the trigger on each cow on that trip. And that money went directly back into that whole project. And that's the big difference. When people try to say that ecotourism does more or doesn't or whatever else, or even the biggest fallacy that the money doesn't stay there, that there's no other place for the money to go. There's nobody taking it out. You know, all the money went into what it was. All the money stayed in Africa. It didn't leave. There's just so many misconceptions. It's what's going on there. And don't get me wrong. There's other parts of Africa that I went to that the political tides were much different and much more out of control. And as a result, things are being abused.
It's a really interesting and kind of new perspective from what I've heard. And one thing I kind of wonder is what are the tribes like that you were eating with there? Because I've had my dad traveled back in, like, I want to say the mid to late 70s. I'm not sure the exact dates. I'd have to ask him. But he hitchhiked with his best friend. I mean, they also took some planes. But from Germany, they started, and they ended in South Africa.
Oh,
and he hitchhiked all the way through Africa. Yeah. And he said one night, one of the things they did to get a ride was help a truck that was delivering supplies and picking supplies up at villages and then, you know, traveling to the next village, dropping off supplies, picking them up, so on and so forth. And at the end of the night, they stopped at all these people. He said every time you would stop at a village, you just stop on a road, and they just come out of the darkness. And you can't see them till, boom, they're right at the truck. And he got to the last village, and they stopped, and the driver gets out. And he's like, follow me. So he follows them, and he goes, we're going in into the woods. And he's like, I don't know if he's going to kill us or what's going to happen. And they get to this village, and they're going through a system of huts, and they finally get to this big kind of it used to be like a central gathering hut, and they're passing around all these foods and stuff. My dad's like, I had no idea what we're eating, but they're passing it around and I'm eating it, you know, because I'm not going to be rude, you know. And it's just one of those experiences that you don't think of living here in America the way we do, of how other people are living over there. For them, that's an everyday business. For my dad, it was strange. But for them, it was just a guest they're welcoming in, you know, into their homes. And this is the way we do things here.
Right. Yeah, it was a different culture. I spent a lot of time with a tracker who was Zulu, and he was from Zimbabwe, 29 years old. I spent almost every day of this trip with him. And his English was pretty good. And but we had a lot of talks, and obviously I'm the type of person, I'm curious in everything. I'm not just curious in hunting. I'm curious in learning about what it was like. And we had a lot of talks about, you know, his lifestyle back home. And, you know, we asked us, you know, the question about lion hunting and, you know, being from Zimbabwe. And again, their perspective on it is just, it's more than ever when I came home. You know, my opinion is that unless you've been to Africa, like, essentially nobody has any business talking about it. Like, it's just everybody's got this, even some of the reporters that are reporting on that country, it's so biased. It's just so biased. It's just so, like, the sources are corrupted. The people are just keyed in on agendas, and it's a weird culture. It's everything was weird about that place. You know, people getting dragged out of huts and eaten by lions in Zimbabwe is normal. you know, going to wash your clothes down by a river over there and getting ripped into the river by a hippo that just wants to throw your body around for sport is commonplace. You know, it's just, again, like I said, it's a place of everything is severe. It's just severities across the board. And it's normal to them. I didn't meet people that weren't friendly. Everybody was very friendly. I never really got in a position where people were trying to shake me down for money as far as trying to sell me anything. I mean, it was for the most part, the only time that, you know, I got shaken down for stuff was for actual money from, you know, I got in a situation coming home from the airport where I had to slip a little money to get through South African police. They were shaking me down. So, but
I've only been shaken down once in all my travels, and you know.
Yeah, I was shaken down because you know what it was. I had so much camera gear with me, and you know, I had more batteries than that were technically legal, and not that any of them really care. Essentially, they just saw that I had a lot of expensive equipment with me. They figured I had money, and you know, I ended up having to slip some cash to make it through at the end of the day.
What's the shakedown cost?
It cost me 800 grand, which is about 700 US dollars. I mean, 70 US dollars.
Oh, wow. That's not bad.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fairly inexpensive shakedown, I would
say. No, yeah. It's fine. Whatever. Hey, everybody wants their cut. I get it. Whatever. It's a different world again. I mean, that money is big to them. You know, it's, you know, the value of money is, again, very different. You know, you can, you know, my salary here translates to well over $1 million a year there, and $1 million and, you know, a million rands over there is almost like living with $1 million a year. It's just a very different world. And tourism in the sense of hunting is big money for that place. I mean, it's not a little amount of money. It is big money. That, you know, it amazes me how many very valuable resources Africa has, but yet still finds themselves in economic crises. I mean, they have the biggest platinum mines, the biggest diamond mines. I mean, their hunting resources are, I mean, there's animals everywhere, literally everywhere. I mean, you don't see white-tailed deer like that. Like you go out and in one drive, you see, you know, zebras, giraffes, kudus, impalas, you know, just all these different animals. You're just like, you can't even learn them all. You're like, what's that? What's that? What's this? Oh, there's something new now. I mean, I even saw wild rhinos. I must have saw almost a dozen wild rhinos while I was there. And again, I thought going there that rhinos were essentially extinct. It couldn't be further from the truth. You know, certain areas, yes. You know, the same thing with elephants. Again, a very just misconception, you know, like, you go to one part of the country and it might be a problem. You go to, or continent, and it might be a problem. You go to a different part of the continent, it's the exact opposite. They're overpopulated. It's just, it's like the U.S. If you go hunting in eastern Massachusetts, there are deer everywhere. We need to kill more deer. And you go to western Massachusetts and you're lucky to see a deer, you know, and what they need to do is stop hunting deer out there, you know, like it's the same way in Africa. And we generalize as Americans, we generalize the whole story with, you know, we've first world problemed it, you know, hashtag save the rhinos, you know, whatever else. Like, and these people have no idea. They just no idea. I mean, what I found even fascinating about the rhinos is that some of the money in the hunts that we went on for this Cape Buffalo will actually be used to saw off the horns of rhinos. And it actually leaves 10% of the horn intact, because if not, it will kill the rhino if they pull it out of the other 10%. And poachers will still kill them for that 10% of the horn. So it's like, what's the point? Like, why are you doing it? Like, what did you do it for? It's a weird place, and people just, you know, people think it's a solution. You didn't solve anything. You literally nothing. And it's overcomplicated. And I mean, I'll go back to Africa. I'm planning on going back to Africa for probably a solid month plus next year. I'm gonna go a little further north. I'll probably do some hunting while I was there. I absolutely loved the bird hunting while I was there. That is the one thing that I really enjoyed.
Wait, so you were disappointed by Africa and you're going back to Africa?
I am. Month? Well, yeah, because again, Africa's huge. I saw a very specific portion of Africa. I want to go further north. I want to get as high as Ethiopia. I want to see different animals. I want to, attempt to hunt some different animals. I'll tell you right now, one of the big things that potentially might be happening over there is so Botswana doesn't allow hunting of elephants. And the southern part of the African continent, they estimate there's over 300,000 elephants, and 150,000 of those elephants are in Botswana alone. And of those 150,000 elephants, the majority of them are contained in one national park in Botswana.
What's the national park? Do you know the name?
I don't know the name of it, actually. It's easy Google search, but I can't remember what I ate for breakfast. So
where's Virunga? Do you know that one?
So one of the interesting things about it is you have an area that's got a density that is far over the carrying capacity of the land. And these elephants are flat out destroying full ecosystems, no different than the issues they have with white-tailed deer destroying ecosystems or wild boar in the south destroying ecosystems. It's the same thing, only elephants literally destroy everything. They uproot trees, they take everything over. And the human to elephant conflict is huge in the area. And now you're presented with a problem. The population has to be reduced because the carrying capacity of land can't stand it anymore. And what's going to happen is you're going to end up in a situation where other animals are going to end up endangered as a result of the overpopulation of elephants. And essentially, they discussed three options. The option was try to move the elephants, which is impossible. It's too expensive. It's too timely. It's too everything. They just can't do it. The next option is to literally cull the herd. And just like they're doing in parts of New York or whatever else, it's like hiring snipers. And they go in and they kill hundreds of elephants at a time. And that's it. They eradicate them. Or they allow hunters to come in. And the World Wildlife Federation, Foundation, of all places, has expressed to the Botswana government that they think hunting is the best option. Because you're going to get people in there who are going to pay $10,000 to shoot an elephant. That elephant's going to get utilized, it's going to get used, and there's going to be $10,000 right into that federal park. And that's something you're not going to get from culling a herd. You're going to pay people money to cull a herd.
Here's the odd thing I find about that. Well, I guess not odd thing. The thing I was surprised about is when, and this is something I was ignorant about, is the Wildlife, World Wildlife Federation, the original WWF, is pro-hunting.
Yeah, they're not. It's actually World Wildlife Fund. We're both messing it up.
A foundation.
It's World Wildlife Fund. Right. They're not anti-hunting. I mean, they have expressed some sentiments, and in this case, they're given a very unbiased opinion, and they're saying, "Listen, like this is the answer." And that essentially is a perfect explanation of Africa. There are places in Africa, as a hunter, I will say, elephants should not be hunted. And there are places in Africa where they need to hunt elephants. And that's what it is. It's a vastly complicated issue. You can't just say, oh, we can't hunt lions anymore because Cecil the lion. It's an irresponsible response to a situation that we know nothing about. And this passion that everybody spewed out over these subjects, it's reckless. It's actually hurting a very difficult situation. And I'll tell you right now, Botswana legalizes elephant hunting. I'm getting on a plane. I'm going.
The place you will be going, by the way, is the Chobe National Park. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but it's spelled Chobe. And the park is widely known for its spectacular elephant population. It contains an estimated 50,000 elephants, perhaps the highest elephant concentration of Africa, and part of the largest continuous surviving elephant population. The elephant population seems to have solidly built up since the 1990s from a few thousand. And the elephants living here are the Kalahari elephants, the largest in size of all the known elephant populations. little knowledge there for you on elephants in Africa from the Natural Born Hunter podcast. And that's an interesting thing you said before about there's places in Africa you believe elephants shouldn't be hunted, and there are places in Africa you believe they should be hunted, which is the paradigm that makes up what a hunter is. You know, in my opinion, what a hunter's one of their core values is, which is the importance of the wildlife, population and health, you know, the game you are hunting, the importance of the herd's survival and health is most important to a hunter than any other person's, because everyone else, you know, sees wildlife as, oh, that's something that's pretty, it's beautiful, I'll give them a name, I've seen them in a movie. But to a hunter, that's their, for a lot of us, our food. You know, a big, you know, part of our diets, and, you know, when that's what you're eating, you're really going to take care of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I know for everybody on this podcast right now, you shoot your own animal, you're far less likely to throw a piece of meat away at the end of dinner. Doesn't happen. You know, it's not like people who store by meat, you know, they throw stuff away all the time. When you grow your own vegetables, when you hunt your own food, your opinion of waste and everything else is vastly changed. You know, and like anything, and African hunting, and I understand where a lot of the stigma is coming from for that place. You know, you can't take the meat back to the U.S., and that's because the CDC has a ban on it. I think it would change Africa a lot if they allowed the meat to come home. I think a lot more people would be more apt to go. I'd be more apt to more aggressively hunt Africa if I could bring the meat home. You know, but that's I don't think that's anything that's going to change.
Though. So there's the flip of the switch, you know. It may be good.
That, yeah.
You know, there's that experience that you'll only experience while in Africa.
Yep.
You know, it kind of.
That's a big.
I guess
a big part.
Special, you know. Yeah, yeah, it is a big part.
And I'll tell you, I mean, I've always wanted to do Alaska, West, you know, all different other places, and I've hunted the South a bunch of times, but Africa again. I went there with very high expectations. I mean, I was filming from getting on that plane, flying on that plane. I was getting off that plane like. You know, holy fucking shit, I'm in Africa.
But if I asked you before you had went, what was your dream hunt? What would you have said?
Cape Buffalo, 100%. Cape Buffalo was my number one dream hunt, wanted to do it my whole life. And candidly, was the most disappointing hunt I've ever had. And, and I think it's because I had just such high expectations.
Why, though?
I just, you know, I read too many Peter Capstick books, I guess.
You know, I guess that's a little lesson for everybody listening is make your own dreams. Don't just let somebody else's dream out.
I mean, honestly, at whitetail hunting, I came home with even bigger respect for whitetail hunting because hunting out there is easy in comparison to whitetail hunting. These guys, you know, you go out and I shot an impala in 15 minutes, and this impala was a tricky animal, according to these guys. In 15 minutes, boom, on the ground. And again, these guys, you know, they hunt wind directions, but they don't wear camo, they don't scent kill, they don't hunt like we do. They're not, you know, even out west in the U.S., you know, is completely different the way they hunt in Africa. I mean, North American animals are just so skittish. And these animals, not to say they're not skittish, but the thing is, you know, if you're rifle hunting, you can shoot these things from 200 yards away, or on top of that, essentially what they're doing is they're just walking at this animal. The animal runs away. They walk at it again. It runs away. They walk at it again. It runs away. Eventually it just gives up and says, all right, I'll let you close enough, and boom, they shoot it. And I just, I don't find that, I mean, I shot a giant Cape Buffalo cow. She was a beast. And, you know, my smallest, you know, Pope and Young buck on my wall was 3,000 times more rewarding. I have those that were more rewarding than that hunt. That were just, you know, it was just, it's just a different mindset. It's just a different world. I'm used to working for it. I'm used to it being tough. I'm used to it. I'm used to understanding that the littlest mistake can cost you a whole hunt. And out there, it's just so forgiving. It's so easy. And I don't mean to discourage people. I would suggest to anybody who's never been to Africa, go to Africa. I intend to go back to Africa. It's just to go expecting what it is. And one thing I'll say about Africa, if you go to Africa, bird hunt. Anybody who goes to Africa, you got to bird hunt. The bird hunting is just, it's unbelievable.
Phil, what do you think about that? That's two guests we've had on now in less than a month that have said the most challenging game to hunt and most rewarding game to hunt is whitetail.
Who all said that, Will?
Baker said, and okay.
Well, yeah, I remember Baker said that if you can kill a whitetail, you can kill anything, which I would say from a skill perspective and a detail perspective, I would probably agree with that. But from a physical perspective, I would disagree with that. So
that's probably fair.
That is
so
fair.
But I don't know, man. I think that there is something to be said about – I've hunted Texas before, and we used to go – you know, this is 14 years ago. We'd go to Texas just to go hunt hogs, you know, just get in another hunt, get some meat around that January, February time frame. And we ended up going to a couple high-fence ranches that they had exotic animals there, you know, and they said this is the Africa of the United States. This is Texas, and you can go hunt just about any animal – you can find an app, not every animal, but most animals in Texas now. And I thought about it. It's like, man, you drive, even some of the properties, maybe 1,500, 2,000 acre ranch, you drive around, it's like, it's a matter of time before you get in front of them and get a shot opportunity. It's not, man, I wonder if I'm going to see this. No, it's just a matter of what is going to take you 15 minutes, or is it going to take you 3 or 4 hours or a day, but you're going to get the opportunity. So, yeah, and with hunting, I mean, I'm definitely in the novice category with hunting whitetail deer. I've done it 4 or 5 years, but you know, in the grand perspective, I've been hunting elk for 22 or 24 years. You know, so it's different. I don't consider myself an expert, but I would agree with you that, yeah, that hunt now, the whitetail hunt that I go into Nebraska. I've been going to Nebraska, and I look more forward to that than a lot of other hunts, you know, recently. So I don't know. I guess, but to each his own. You know, I don't know that if somebody just wants to go out and whack them and stack them and experience different game, I don't know, man. I mean, I guess, like you said, you got to try it if that's what you want to do. But how many days were you out there, AJ?
I was there for about 2.5 weeks. I mean, again, it comes down to this question. Do I think Africa, you know, hunting in Africa is necessary to save Africa as far as wildlife is concerned? Yes. Is there, hold on, I'm trying to really think of the correct wording for this. There's plenty of animals I would never hunt in Africa. And it's because I don't find it to be a challenge. I don't want to use the word ethical.
You cannot want to hunt something and still be a diehard hunter.
Yeah, it's not my cup of tea. And that's just because it's not my cup of tea doesn't mean I disagree with it. There's plenty of people, especially the European culture is huge in hunting there. They want to do it. They want to just like, you know, you know, Will was mentioning earlier the whole podcast they did about the rhino hunt. And there was that guy hunting on there that specifically was going for this one head for his wall, and that was his thing. And I get it. People collect, people do that. And it's necessary. It's necessary because they need the money. And it's not wasteful. And that's, I guess, the biggest thing why I think it's okay, is because that animal's being used. Just because that guy killed it and he's not going to eat it and he's still going to eat beef at the end of the night, which is a personal choice. You know, they're paying for something, and the rest of that meat still gets eaten, whether it's by the professional hunters in the camp, the trackers, the local villages, whatever else. it's a preference thing at the end of the day. And I just have this thing where, you know, I killed a bear once and hated bear meat. And I forced myself to eat that entire friggin' thing. And I hated every single ounce of that animal. And I ate it. I ate the whole thing. It's all I ate all year. And that's me. That's just the way I am. And some people don't care about that. And if it's helping conservation, as far as I'm concerned, it's necessary. And to each his own. So,
how many other animals did you hunt other than the Cape Buffalo and the Impala?
How many birds did you kill?
I had a chance to hunt a lot of big game, and I opted out. I chose not to. I had a chance to hunt zebra, wildebeest, water buck. I did try to do a little warthog hunt, and I just didn't have any luck. Every time I saw a warthog, I had a camera in my hand.
You're
gonna
Umba.
Yeah. But it just didn't do it for me. I didn't even really intend on killing the Impala. And we had went out, and essentially the guy, you know, the PH that was with us was like, oh, nobody can kill that Impala. And to me, that was a challenge. So I was like, oh, watch this. And, 15 minutes later, I come back to the truck with it. So, it's just, but again, you know, even the tracker I was with, what he wanted to do was jump out of that truck, and they wanted to walk straight at it and keep hunting straight at it. And I was like, no, we're doing it my way. We're doing it, you know, the way we do it in the U.S. We're getting clever here. And we shot off to the left. We went up this dry riverbed and cut it off coming into another clear cut. And I shot it when it came into the clear cut. Well, not clear cut. It was a field. I mean, it's not New England. But anyways, I don't know. I didn't shooting a zebra wasn't happening. I got the most excited when I saw a zebra the first time, which was kind of surprising for myself. And because where I was initially hunting zebra were very elusive. It was very thick cover. So we had been hunting all day, and all of a sudden I heard like the stampeding, and I was like, oh my God, what's that? And, you know, I see this flash of a zebra at like 100 yards through this thick brush, and I just lost it. I was like, oh my God, it's a fucking zebra. You know, like I'm in Africa, that's a zebra. And they definitely blew my mind when I first saw them. And then the capacity, you know, we were in a different part of Africa when I had an opportunity to hunt zebra, and they were a lot easier to get near. And I just, it's just not, you know, I'm not going to do the high fence thing. I'm not going to, it's just not a choice of mine. It's not. And you know what? There's things that are going on good because of that stuff. And like anything, certain things are being abused, but it is a necessary part of what's going on there. I mean, South Africa in particular is like Texas. It is essentially one big high fenced hunting ranch. And whatever, Texas people love it. South Africans love it. I don't, it's not my thing. Yeah. I love hunting a deer that has definitely been to whatever my local market basket is that I shop at, or, you know, runs across wherever I live and, you know, almost gets hit by my car on the regular. Like, that's just me. That's what I want. So,
yeah, no, I hear you. When I went to Texas too, it was early on, we got into a little bit of exotic hunting. And then the more I got into bow hunting, it was like, you know what, this didn't quite seem right, you know?
Yeah. It's just not.
No, and then I just reverted back to shooting hogs for meat and enjoying the camaraderie of the family and friends and the hunting camp atmosphere. But you're right. That's the one thing that kind of hangs me up from the stories I hear about Africa is.
Yeah, there's a lot of high fencing going on out there in South Africa.
The perception is not, you know, I guess it's not as it appears once you're there. But
no.
Anyway.
And that's why bird hunting, I mean, the bird hunting is just off the hook. They have this bird out there. They call it a Franklin, and it's our equivalent to essentially a rough grouse like we have out here. And they're a little smaller. They look very similar. They flush the same as a rough grouse. But, like, I go hunting in northern New Hampshire, and, like, last year I would walk a mile and be lucky to see a bird in the mountains. Yeah. And one thing I'll say about most of the terrain I was in there, it's not as bad as the terrain in New England. Western Mass is to me, a train wreck in comparison to Africa. You go into logging country where they're just dumping logs down and they're not taking off brush, and forget about it. It's way worse than African cover. The swamps in eastern Massachusetts are much harder to get through than their bush. You know, it's you know, in those senses. But, you know, here, again, like I said, you take, you know, you walk a mile and you're lucky to flush one grouse. Out there, you walk a mile and you might flush 10 to 20 Franklin. And wow. They're wild. You know, it's not, you know, you can't high fence a Franklin. So, and they're just everywhere. And they're a blast to hunt. And for anybody out there who's really into rough grouse culture, this was the little peace offering coming from rough grouse community in the U.S. over to Africa. So the first day we shot some Franklin, I came back and I was like, oh, you know, do you clean these things like we clean rough grouse? And I don't know if you guys ever cleaned rough grouse before, but at least in New England, we spread their wings out. And you put your feet into either side of the wings next to the body.
On the legs.
And you just pull the legs out, and that's how you clean them. So they don't clean Franklin like that there. And I'm with their cook, who barely speaks any English. And, you know, he's fluent in Zulu. And I'm like, hey, I'm trying to show him this. So, you know, and I didn't know if it was going to work. And sure enough, I spread this Franklin's wings out, and I get it and everything else, and I rip the legs. And sure enough, it cleans the whole thing out. And this guy... he had the most shocked look on his face. Like, he was just like, what? so they all, that's how they started cleaning the birds now in that particular area.
Yeah,
so
yeah, that's how we do Africa. Pheasant too. Yeah, so.
Yeah, they didn't clean them like that, which I thought was unusual. The other bird we hunted was a guinea fowl. It's a really big bird. It's about half the size of a turkey.
I'll put a picture. We're raising them.
Oh yeah, they're and they're just
like crazy.
Yeah, they're weird. They're kind of different to hunt. You got to kind of circle around them and try to, you know, fly them into another group of guys. But it's a blast, and they're all good eating. The Franklins, everything. I actually hunted. I didn't get to hunt as much as I wanted to while I was there. I actually only hunted personally maybe about 4 days of the whole trip, but the day we first bird hunted, all the guys didn't want to hunt midday. I went out midday by myself, and the heat is brutal out there. There's no doubt about it. It's super dry. The sun is strange. It, this time of year, at least, you don't really get a sunburn from it, but it's just brutally hot. And what I did find is hunting midday for Franklin, A, have a lot of water, but B, they hold in cover a lot closer for you in that heat than they would in the early mornings or the late afternoons. So I ended up, I hunted midday and I crushed it on Franklin. Like it was so much fun. I was out there for like 4 hours. I mean, God knows how many miles I covered. And eventually I ran out of water. I had to turn back. So, I kind of rationed my way, and I was like, I don't know if I really want to get in, you know, a survival situation in Africa for my first time here. So I'll leave that to, the New England mountains. But, yeah, it was cool. The bird hunt, 100%. Like, if you're going, you got to bird hunt while you're there. You just got to do it. It's just so much fun. The dog training, any dogs I've hunted over here are far better trained than the dogs over there. And again, maybe it's just where I was, or, you know, the dogs we were on with, they're relatively new, but, you know, it was cool. I'll do it again. Like I said, I'm going back next year. I mean, mind you, if all the people I have for contacts here don't hate me after this interview.
I think you'll be okay.
Yeah. No, it's interesting to hear, you know, your perspective on there. 'Cause you said you were there for 16, 18 days. You hunted for 4 days.
Yeah.
A lot of photography, a lot of video.
Yeah.
Travel.
I spent a lot of time filming other people hunting. I spent a lot of time taking photos, and we did spend a lot of time traveling. So we covered essentially from Johannesburg all the way up to Botswana and then over into Mozambique. There was a lot of traveling. And we got into situations where, you know, they go to a specific place. Like, if you wanted to hunt wildebeest or zebra, or, you know, they'd go over to a different concession or something and say, oh, this is where we're going to hunt them. So they'd have to travel there. And in most of those cases, I wasn't interested in hunting. So I just, you know, I took pictures, hung out, drank beers, had a good time. You know, I enjoyed it. And, you know, that's, you know, it's Africa. It's, it was cool. I'll still probably hunt cave buffalo again for the record. I'll probably go back to shoot a, you know, I shot a cow. And maybe I'll go back to Africa to shoot a bull. I don't know.
What's your favorite thing you did on the trip?
I mean, bird hunting. I loved it. I was obsessed. I even went out. We were leaving early morning the last day, and I woke up. I mean, I was beat. I hunted hard every day. And for me, when I go hunting, and I know you two are the same way, hunting's not a vacation. Hunting is you use up every ounce of energy, and when you come home, you run into the ground because you have burnt yourself out. That's what I did while I was there. Those other guys, you know, were doing a lot more leisurely, and I understand that's what some people want to do. But I ran myself into the ground the last few days bird hunting, and I even got up again after being up super late. I got up super early in the morning, went out, and honestly, the last 100 yards of, you know, tracks I made on Africa and in a property I could hunt, I ended up shooting one more Franklin, and it was just so satisfying, you know, an awesome wing shot. So I was just like, oh my God, I'm leaving Africa on such a high note. Cause I'm not the best wing shooter in the world. So, Will, you'll find that out in October.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm going to go do a little, bird hunting with AJ in Northern New Hampshire in October, Phil.
Awesome. Yeah. Too bad you guys are on the opposite side of the world from me. I might be able to join you on something like that.
Well, you're closer than Africa, Phil, if you want to
have that's for sure.
Out here.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to be hunting mostly woodcock.
I know you love the woodcock, Phil.
Hey. I don't know any other cock, man.
No cock beats woodcock. I noticed your t-shirt, AJ. What's that say?
Oh, you've never
hunter,
seen
noun, pronounced hunter, a person who pays for 90% of the cost for the preservation and maintenance of wildlife and gets no credit. Now, where could a person who maybe, you know, believes that and wants to wear that on their chest get such a shirt?
That's a huntergreen.org t-shirt.
That's huntergreen.org for those who may not have heard it on the first podcast. And
well, it depends who you are. Some people will say it's an organization built on the propaganda of pro hunting.
Other people, it's like a dangerous organization.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we get tons of it.
I hope you're not affiliated with them.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, recently I tend to get blamed for writing every article that they write. And, honestly, I haven't written an article for Hunter Green in a minute, so it's there's actually a lot more talent other than me involved in Hunter Green.
You know what would make a great article for huntergreen.org?
What? How to safely get through a podcast without ruining your hunting career?
Well, you know, that's not gonna happen. Maybe a New Mexico elk hunt. Of, you know, maybe somebody who got some sort of unique perspective on hunting elk in New Mexico could write an article for huntergreen.org.
Wow, it sounds like this is a very guided conversation.
No, this is 100% natural. Coming off the tip of my head.
Yeah, no, yeah, anything we... Go ahead, go, Phil.
Maybe we can reach out to our listeners and see if there's anybody out there that's hunted New Mexico recently.
Phil, do you know anyone who's hunted in New Mexico recently?
I do.
Who?
I do. Guy that lives in the south part of the state that I know. Couple other guys, you know, mutual friends from other people. But I know a few people.
Did any of them catch anything unique and different, though?
I don't know. I haven't talked to all of them.
No? Don't know it. Do you know anyone, though, who has?
It depends. You know, the New Mexico is called the land of enchantment. I'm sure there's a lot of interesting and unique things that happen to get caught on,
Phil,
you know, in
squirrely bastard.
Hey, Will, I'm going to end this real quick. I'm going to give you one glimpse, right, and that's it, of an interesting situation that I encountered in New Mexico. and you got to be watching the audio or watching the video portion of the podcast.
You know, so what? That's not even going to help all you audio people out and narrate what it is Phil is showing us right now on the screen. But it is a very, very cool shot. And who took that shot, Phil? Or picture, shall I say?
That picture was taken off a screenshot from the video that was basically filming off the front of my stabilizer on that hunt. So, yeah, there'll be more to that later on.
How close were you?
I was within 30 yards. To the point where I almost got trampled, let's put it that way. I mean, at that point where I was filming that, I was within 30 yards. Once the animals kind of dispersed, I got about 5 to 7 yards to one of them when they were hauling ass, like, parting ways, and I jumped behind a tree.
Why were they hauling ass so fast, Phil?
Maybe one of them, you know, one of them didn't like what they felt. I'm not sure.
That's why I told you never try to mount a bull elk when you're out hunting, Phil.
Let me tell you something. Velcro gloves work better on sheep than they do on elk. So I'll leave you with that.
I'm going to use that one tomorrow at work.
But, yeah, there'll be more of that later. You got, like I said.
More Velcro gloves.
maybe we're going to have to do some Natural Born Hunter Velcro gloves and market those.
Oh, shit.
Those gloves. But
you know what? No, wait. This is going to sound terrible. You know what? Keep going with your train of thought. I don't want to go off on a tangent.
I don't know, man. Like I said, it was an incredible experience up there. And my cousin Matt, who was with me, he's a guide. They have their family business, have a guide outfit out there. And he broke away from guiding clients to come with me and help me on that trip. And it was awesome, man. It just, like I said, we got to spend a lot of time in the woods, and we got into some elk and it was all about the experience. I mean, getting to take home an elk was great, and it wasn't there are some big bulls in New Mexico, and I've seen big bulls in there, and it wasn't about the trophy. It wasn't about any of that this time. It was spending time with some family on the mountain and working our ass off, because I tell you what, we worked our ass off. Like you said, AJ, we were up, you know, way early. We were only getting maybe 5 to 6 hours of sleep a night, you know, and part of it was because we decided not to camp there. We decided they had access to a lodge because they are outfitters, and it was 25, 30 minutes down the road from where you start accessing the national forest. So it wasn't private property. It was all, you know, it was all a public land hunt. And like I said, and then getting to catch that 10, 12 seconds of that video clip on my stabilizer, I couldn't believe it. I didn't know. So after I shoot, let's put it this way, I'll tell you this much. After I shoot, and I'm kind of, you know, I kind of watched the bull where it went, and I'm kind of gathering myself, and I'm there are other bulls still bugling. There's cows everywhere. I looked down at my camera, and it was off. And anybody who knows a GoPro, after the battery dies, the sucker just, you know, you don't know when it does. It just shuts off. So it was, you know, we found some blood, and we ended up backing out. It was right before dark. We drove it was an hour drive back to where we were staying from after we hiked back out. So literally we get back to the cabin, you know, and it was 11:30, and I'm sitting there, and I was like, I need to turn on the computer. So I turned on my computer and I put in the chip and I start watching some of the footage, and I can see the little line going to the end of the clip, like it's about to end, and then stuff starts to happen and I'm like, oh shit, maybe I got it, you know. And then it gets closer towards the end and I think I might have got it, you know. And I'll leave it at that. It was a timing thing. It was a few seconds of you know, it wasn't a great, again, a GoPro. I've got a GoPro with a custom lens, so it's not a fisheye view. It's a little bit better view of what you're seeing. You know, it's like a 6-power lens on there, so it's equivalent to. So it's a little bit better lens quality, but still moving around. running through the woods there and, having a camera on the end of your stabilizer when you're shooting, a little bit of nerves, you're that close to elk, right in their, in their moment. And it was one of those experiences that I will tell my kids and my grandkids that story over and over and over again. My dad's got the stories that he tells, and I don't get tired of hearing them. I've probably heard some of his hunting stories 20 times, because when we're around new company or new crowds and he tells hunting stories, I get to listen to it again. And that's going to be one of those stories that, to me, I think that hopefully it has the same value to my kids in that time. But it's one of those deals, like I said, it was – I took the pictures of the animal afterwards, and I was like, this hunt to me wasn't about the rack. It's not about that. It was just about that moment in time, that evening, and getting to experience that. And like I said, it was priceless, is what it was. So I'm excited to be able to bring that to add some video flavor to some stuff that we do later on.
It's interesting, a few things you hit on there, and I obviously can't wait to see the video and what you do with it, and congratulations obviously for what may or may not have happened out there. And
appreciate it.
One thing you guys kind of both touched on tonight is, what is it about that feeling of going out hunting and putting everything you have into it, and when that sweat is really dried on you and you feel totally fatigued and you're kind of, you feel really awake but you're blinking a lot and you're tired and you're out there in the woods or in the wilds, wherever you are, and you've never really felt more alive or better when you're out there in that moment of the hunt. And that becomes kind of the feeling of hunting to you, and what hunting is that sustained tiredness, that sustained fatigue, but that adrenaline is that excitement is still keeping you up. The hopes of finding what you're looking for, the next day is what keeps you, getting only 3 hours of sleep at the campfire, with your buddies telling stories, and you got to wake up early and you're like, oh, we should go to bed, but things go on way late into the night, and you get up early and you push all your limits. And then you go to, something like Africa, like AJ's talking about, and it's not that experience. And you're like, maybe this is the new romanticized hunting. Maybe it has become a better version of what was written about before,
Yeah, I can agree with that for sure.
There was a couple moments there, Will, that, like you said, you're in the moment. You don't feel how tired. So to kind of go off on a little tangent on the hunt of this story there, to touch on what you just said, I think it might have been the second morning or the third morning. I can't remember. It's kind of a blur now, but we got some elk bugling, and I started chasing them. My cousin stayed behind me calling, and I dropped my pack, and I had in my pack, I had my GPS, I had my water, I had my food, I had everything, right? And I'm in a new area of which spent very little time in, and I'm pretty familiar with navigation and hunting and I understanding where you're at. But I go in after these elk because they kind of started moving out the other way, and I was just kind of just chasing the herd and trying to get close and checking the wind and hunting, and I turned around, once I finally got into these elk, and I almost shot a cow. I'll tell you that. I come around, I got that close to the bull where he was bugling, where I thought he was like right there. So I come around a tree and I see this body of this elk, and I can see it from about the shoulder back. And I started almost drawing my bow back. I mean, it was 35 yards away. I'm like, that thing is huge. That's got to be the bull right there. It sounded like he was right there. So I'm about half draw, and I see cows, little calves start popping up behind this animal, and I'm like, and I let down. I said, is that a cow? And it's like, it can't be. That thing is huge. Well, sure enough, I waited, and these these more cows start popping out, and I'm looking, and I kind of leaned over a little bit to try to get a better view of the shoulder forward. It was a cow. So I almost ended my hunt right there by being mistaken. But long story short, those elk moved right in front of me, like 15 yards. So I got them on camera there too, and they pushed off. Well, when they all pushed off, and I let them be because I was like, you know what, I followed these elk for a while. They're about to bed down somewhere. I don't want to spook them out. I can get back into them this afternoon. I looked down at my watch, and I had been after those elk for 2.5 hours. And I'm like, holy smokes, you know, how far can I be? Because I never stopped moving. You know, so there was times where I moved slowly. There was times where I was moving faster. Always on a walk, slow walk to a faster walk sometimes, but I never stopped. So then I looked down, and on this hill that we were hunting, it was basically a mountain that was just one side of this east-facing slope. And I've got my watch is the only tool that I had that shows elevation. And I said, okay, well, I'm not going to get lost. I got to get to the elevation where I knew we were, and I side-hill it all the way back. Well, it took me 1.5 hours to hike back. By this time, you know, it's almost noon. My cousin's getting nervous because we have no method of communication. He found my pack, and so he knew that I had my water, my food, my GPS, and any other. I mean, the only thing I carry on my bino harness, my Alaska Guide Creations bino harness, is
you don't have one, get one.
I've got my binos. You know, with Aaron, he kind of taught me a couple things. I put a lighter in there. I got some Advil in my deal, and I had eaten the day before my granola bar that I usually stick in the front of that thing. No food, but I have my lighter, I have my rangefinder, my binos, and my Advil, and I'm like, well, so long story short, I hike all the way back out. And like you said, I got back to where my pack was, wasn't hungry, wasn't thirsty. I was like, you know what, I almost got, you know, I was that close. And so my cousin's like, hey, man, you know, next time. And I was like, no, I was almost there, you know. I was right there. I almost shot him. And he's nervous. He's like, well, next time we split. I was like, no, let me tell you the story about what happened, you know. So he's nervous about getting lost and food. And I'm like, you know what, that's the farthest thing from my mind in that 3 or 4 hour time period because of that experience. And going back to when we had Ryan with Rockslide on. You know, he said, oh, the people that say turkey hunting is like elk hunting, they're dead wrong. And I'm like, yeah, no, this is not turkey hunting. You know, when you get that close to, you know, 600-plus pound animals and they're screaming in your face and you're right there. And I don't know, man, it was, like I said, it was an awesome 4 days that I spent up there. Happy to bring home meat. And we've had elk steaks the last two nights. So it was awesome because little tough, not gonna lie, but the flavor is to me second to none. Elk meat to me is awesome. So, you know, you're talking about the experience and the motions and I tell you what, I think about that. I don't think about anything. I think other than just being in the moment at that moment. So with AJ, I mean, I think you can relate with experience in the whitetail going to the Cape Buffalo, and then, man, I can't wait to get back to that whitetail, you know, because you know how challenging and how rewarding it is and just that chess game, you know.
100%.
Yeah. Well, I know AJ's got to get going soon, and since, you know, Phil's showing us a little something, I'm gonna show you guys a little something that's currently being worked on right now.
Oh.
See that? Oh, yeah. Two colors. There will be some gear available for you who are natural born hunter. And
AJ, so yes. I'm not going to cut Will off because last time it took him like, I don't know, there was like 8 or 10 guys that had shirts before I did. So I want to talk to AJ a little bit more about before we have to let you go. Because I'll come back to Will with the logo stuff and the gear stuff, because I'm sure I'll get one in like 1 or 3 or 6 months. Sure. But you've got a lot of things in the works, man. I mean, you've got some other projects you're working on, and where are you at with some? I know we touched on some of those last time, but I know that you've gotten further along with some other projects.
Yeah, I'm actually October 1 we'll launch two films in the Advent, Searching being one of them, which Will got to get a little sneak peek of the rough draft of the film tonight, as well as another film, Carbon Wingprint, that I was able to produce with huntergreen.org. We're actually heading over to the studio tonight to record the final voiceovers for both films. Yeah, this season, we're going to be filming a lot of bird hunting, potentially working with a nonprofit organization that we'll not mention at this time.
And your boy, Will Bradley.
Yes, you're going to be coming to do some woodcock hunting with us. So a lot of rough grouse hunting and woodcock hunting for us this year. We have some deer hunting stuff we're doing this year. We're going to be filming at least one Origins hunt, which is a traditional archery film with whitetail. We're also going to be filming at least one or two films for the Whitetail Confidential series, which is all whitetail hunting. We have a Cape Buffalo film coming out. I guess I kind of ruined that film for a lot of people because the film's going to be way more epic than the way I told it here today. I guess it's a good project for people to look at and say, oh, wow, the way it actually happened and the way you can perceive it in film can be two very different things. what else are we going to be doing? Potentially some waterfowling down south. Depends if our schedule works out to do it. What else? We get a turkey film coming out for turkey season. We get an ice fishing film coming out for the winter. So we do have a lot of projects coming up. Still working on some writing. We get some great articles that I should be cranking out on huntergreen.org in the next few weeks. We get something coming out about elephant hunting, something coming out about public land sale in the U.S., big hot topic. We get a lot of projects going along. I'm pretty most excited about bird hunting, though, strangely enough. I'll probably do some, you know, whitetail hunting myself this year, but I'm not going to be chasing any Pope and Young Bucks around. I can't afford to pick up that obsession this year. So.
Wow. Dang. That's news in itself. All right. And if people want to check your stuff out, AJ, where do they head to?
You're interested in the book, you're interested in suburban deer hunting, urbandeercomplex.com. We have some articles coming out this week up on there, some stuff relevant to this time of year for suburban hunting. Huntergreen.org, if you're interested in sustainability, the controversy of hunting. We're very proactively and aggressive in targeting the anti-hunting community and really sticking our necks out to fight that fight. We do films there as well. And as far as any other projects that we're associated with, we do go to dangerouscow.com. You can link up to anything we're working on. Some behind the scenes stuff going on with Will, she'll not mention unless Will feels like he wants to mention it. And as well as, we still have Basic Huntsman coming out, got a little delayed because of Africa. But that site should be up and running for everybody for October 1. It's going to be, take a little bit of time to get the kind of information we need up on that website. But at least we'll get the ball rolling and get people talking about it and get people asking questions, which, that whole platform is geared towards people that have never hunted before. So that's what it is. I want people to be able to start asking questions during their hunting season this year and actually be able to seek out advice there.
Yeah. You know what? He's also on Instagram. You can check him out. And Facebook with that stuff. I'll talk a little bit about what we're working on. We're going to get another podcast launched that's going to be related more to other outdoor sports, as well as a little one that will be kind of a shorter podcast that focuses on really cool stuff that's being handmade in America. And I've got a couple of those recorded, and there's just some really cool guests out there doing some really cool stuff. So looking forward to launching those. Phil, how about you? As always, check out the championship bow hunting site and page. Phil needs to get me a workout because this month I am posting all the workouts for the Train to Hunt on their Facebook page, and wouldn't everybody love to do those workouts Phil is doing that makes him so good in the field?
Will, like I told you, man, my working out was hiking my can up and down that mountain, and packing out some meat. And lately, my gym work. My gym workouts have been very bland, man. It's been just kind of some maintenance, some cardio, and low impact stuff because hiking up and down the mountain.
That's what I want. No, I want bang.
I've got 3 days to hunt left. I got Friday, Saturday, Sunday for elk here in Colorado to try to close the deal and the season end. So I'm not trying to kill myself before I get the last 3 days of the season, man.
I understand. So, all right. Well, the end of the month, I got about a week before the end of the month, Phil. So that gives you a couple days postseason. You can get me some workouts. All right, ladies and gentlemen. As always, this has been the Natural Born Hunter podcast. It's really been a pleasure to have AJ on again. I'll give you a little hint who we got coming up. We will have at some point one of the guys from Maven coming on, who, if any of you have seen, I think it was Filled and Stream just voted them one of the best binoculars you could get, especially
it's
for the
so pro. Accurate. So accurate.
Yeah. Oh, shit. We were supposed to touch it. The one thing we talk about tonight, AJ.
Number one piece of gear that I had in Africa, my Maven optics. Literally every professional hunter tried to steal them from me. And so Maven knows I did bring them home.
So that was the one thing we really wanted to talk about tonight. And obviously we failed at talking about them. But we will have, I think it's Brendan, on from Maven optics somewhere in October, and we will also have the Harbertson brothers on again coming up. So for all of those of you who are buying Mountain Ops products, don't forget the coupon code NBH20 to get 20% off all of your purchases at Mountain Ops. And the return of Ben Greenfield and the Shirtless Podcast, tits out. This has been the Natural Born Hunter Podcast. Wake up, chase your dreams, repeat.